Did you know that the average temperature of the universe is minus 455 degrees Fahrenheit? Or that its most abundant element is hydrogen? Well, over a 128-year history, National Geographic magazine has made explaining the seemingly unexplainable its mission. Much of it by way of infographics. How exactly do they do it? Well, we'll find out today on The Stack. From Midori House in London, this is The Stack, 30 minutes of print industry analysis. I'm Tom Edwards. Coming up today, a few newsstands are quite as stuffed with local and international titles than those scattered throughout the streets of Italy. Today, we'll take a look behind the scenes of the iconic Italian magazine Panorama.
30 years ago, the editor-in-chiefs didn't feel compulsory to cover in detail what was going on outside the borders of Italy, but now we are doing it.
But first, it would ordinarily take quite a while to sift through 128 years of infographic history from the pages of National Geographic magazine. But fear not, a new anthology published by Tashin has done all the sorting for us. From microwave and infrared to micron and angstrom, National Geographic Infographics gathers some of the magazine's most fascinating graphic illustrations and presents them in a way that all your old school textbooks simply never could. I'm joined today, I'm delighted to say, by the book's editor, Julius Wiedemann. Julius, great to see you. Thanks for coming to see us again at Monocle. A regular visitor now. That's a nice thing, isn't it?
Oh, it's such a pleasure. thank you very much. Keep inviting me.
We will do. Well, especially when there's such beautiful works. Now, we're going to talk about magazines, of course, and newspapers and publishing broadly. But just to kick off a little bit with Tashin, because this is something we've talked about on Monocle 24 before. One thing I particularly like about the National Geographic Infographics book is how it bridges the two worlds. Obviously, something amazing from the world of magazines, and then it comes to the world of book publishing. Was that a particular pleasure working on this, that you could bring something from magazine land, these amazing infographics which fans of National Geographic know and celebrate, and you could bring them into the world of books? That must have been particularly delightful for you to work on, I guess.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think I have a number of things that I loved about doing this book. And of course, Tashin is known for like putting these collections together and so on. And we did two books on photography with National Geographic as well. But photography is a territory for books as well. So it's natural to see photography in books. I think you're absolutely right when you say that we kind of bridged that gap between, you know, something that is naturally for magazines and then putting all that together. I mean, what gave me a lot of pleasure, and there are a few things that gave me a lot of pleasure doing this book. One thing is the research. I mean, I literally had to go through all magazines since 1888.
That's going to take a while, I'm guessing.
It took a little while, you know, I underestimated that. I thought in the beginning, it was like, oh, you know, I can do that in a couple of months and I calculate the number of pages and stuff, but it's impossible. I mean, the thing is that you stop at some point, not just like flicking through and selecting things, but also like, oh my God, this is so interesting. So like, I have to read a little bit. So like by reading first one paragraph and then two and three, and then you, it consumes a lot of time. But it was an incredible pleasure to be able to find out through National Geographic's point of view, the kind of the history of the last almost 130 years. And that's pretty amazing.
Now tell me about how you consider yourself a Jew, because it strikes me as interesting. We think of Tashin, obviously, this publisher of amazing books, but you've worked in magazines. We're going to talk about some magazines you've brought with you as well in a minute, but you've worked in newspapers and quite, I don't know, esoteric newspapers as well, different languages, different markets that are very interesting for us here at Monocle, of course, like
Japan we talked about.
Yeah, exactly, example, yeah. Which is really interesting. How do you consider yourself? Are you a newspaper man? Are you a magazine man? Are you a books man? Or are you all of those things?
I'm certainly today all of those things. Today I'm much more a bookman than anything else, of course, because, you know, I've edited 70 books with Tashin, and it's a very interesting way that we've found out a thing through Benedict, you know, how we do things, and, you know, he has his particular approach, and I think we all learn and then we exchange a lot. I always loved the medium magazine. When you work in a newspaper, you know, by the end of the day, and when you receive the newspaper back, and I was doing a weekly newspaper, actually, but by the end of that week, I mean, you have to get on with the next one, so you don't have time to improve. With books, I mean, you really, we're talking about 12, 18 months of an ideal, you know, time frame, and sometimes it will take 3 years, but it's rare. But, you know, by the end of that process, I mean, you've seen a lot of things. You really want to see it printed. Mm. Magazine is really, it's that sweet spot that you have to stay creative and you have to keep thinking about new ways and new themes, subjects, approaches to everything, at the same time that you have a little bit of time to improve everything that you're doing. Mm. So that's what I think, it's wonderful to work with magazines.
Tell me about magazines then. So in your day-to-day, let's say you're, I don't know, browsing a newsstand, maybe you have a favourite one. What do you look for in your magazines now? Do you have old favourites you go back to? You know, is your eye drawn to that yellow frame of National Geographic still? Or do you, would you just buy something on instinct, see a cover that just grabs you, or a cover line? What's that process like for you now?
Yeah, I think I use a couple of processes. Sometimes I'm looking for certain types of information because I'm working on a book, for example. Mm. So I'll look for magazines in terms of trying to find the most current, you know, articles about the subject and so on. And this is one aspect of magazines that is great. The other thing, I have my favorites. I have certain types of magazines. I look for good journalism as well.
This is a good thing, generally.
Everyone should take the time to read things and not just see the post on Instagram. And I post on Instagram and I use it and so on and so forth. And I read like just three sentences, but looking for magazines that have, that really work hard on journalism, I think that's is a key thing for me. So that's why, for example, I read The Economist, or I'll read Monocle. Or The Economist is a magazine, for example, I'm not a conservative, not exactly, but I like to read it because I want to read the point of view from other people, but I also want to make sure that it is really good journalism. So I don't agree with everything, but it's fine because, you know, I'll just get loads of information. As I think, for example, diversity is so important because it's not very covered from everywhere. So when things are not covered from everywhere. So one thing that I know, for example, so if I just open the last issue from Monaco, and then you have stuff from Japan and from Argentina. This is very rare to see. Mm. And because I lived in four different countries and worked in different languages and so on, that for me is another parameter that is absolutely important, is that if I find a diversity that represents a certain type of world that I live, I mean, it's not for everyone maybe, but at least for me, this is one thing that I look at.
And what's the secret to that? Just on that point, is it about publications that are spending money, that are really investing in good storytelling, good photography, good writing? Or can you actually achieve that sense without necessarily spending money? Is it more about an attitude, or does expressing that kind of attitude necessarily kind of cost money?
I think there are a lot of things these days that you can do spending very little money. Mm. But I'm very careful just generalizing that, because when I do a book today, one of the things that I ask myself is always like, would someone be able to find these if they do like a Google image search, if they spend 2 hours doing that? So what I always joke about, actually, in a sense, is that the book is a knowledge-saving machine for a person. Because if I would just say, let's say, like, my hour is really cheap, okay? It's like £10 an hour. And then if I would need like 100 hours to find all this material online, because a lot of stuff is online. I mean, you know, that's what a lot of the doctoral theses are about. I mean, they go to a database, they read a lot of papers, and they might do an experiment or not. But if we go from the perspective that you really need to invest so much time, a good medium is already worth it, like 100 times. And the other thing, what you asked is specifically about costs. I think if we don't invest at least some amount of money, and we're talking about sending someone somewhere, or like paying a good person to write, or something, or paying someone to spend the time to write something really well, we don't innovate. And I think that's the key issue. I mean, we can do a good thing. I once had an interview with a neo-French guy from advertising. But he told me something quite interesting. He said, you know, doing a good advertising is very easy. Doing a really good advertising is really difficult.
I think it's a very sage distinction. It talks a little bit about the ethos of Monocle as well, I think, Julius. Let's talk about magazines more specifically, because you already mentioned your enthusiasm, and you have a selection here, a couple of which actually you've mentioned already. Tell us about some of these. Are these all long-term favourites? Are they things that you've maybe come back to? What should we start with? What have you got first?
So I got here, for example, the New Scientist magazine, and I am as sceptic a person as you will ever find. So I always like to write anything about science, which I think is really important for us, and I think has shaped society in a way that we couldn't have seen it without that process. Mm. But it's like democracy, you know. Well, it's not the perfect system, but it's not.
It's the best we've got, maybe. And it's interesting in this, you know, alternative fact landscape that we're in. You know, the New Scientist, it's based mainly on empiricism, isn't it? So
exactly.
it's as good as we've got.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, it's about the process which you should at least for some purpose find some information. And so but what I'm interested with New Scientist, I read also like Scientific American, for example, which is another very good magazine, but it's about making that very accessible without being techie, so to speak. It's really about like how can you put that in context and how that affects us. Because when we talk about violence or we talk about climate change, we tend to think, for example, that these two things are very separate, but they're actually not so separate. So, you know, if you can connect that through data, to real data that is analyzed and is, you know, there's someone that is credible, that is writing and so on. So I think that's what I look at when I get my New Scientist, like almost every month.
Now, it's interesting. If we look at this sort of world of technology and innovation, I know you've got a copy of Wired as well.
Yeah.
And this is another interesting title, which I guess, again, it walks that interesting line between a mainstream, you know, a mass market magazine, but then it's also dealing with some tech innovative issues, which maybe could be a little dry. But again, they strike a pretty intelligent balance for their readers.
Yeah, what I like about Wired is how they translate the geekness, so to speak, about the technology world into something that is, you know, digestible. Mm. It also, I mean, I love the design of the magazine, and as a visual person, you know, I appreciate that. We published in our books on information graphics, we published a number of works that they've done, because it's really outstanding. The time that they spend just doing some of their infographics, like National Geographic as well. You know, they would work with scientists like for 2 or 3 months just to get a piece really right. And this is the kind of thing that I really appreciate.
Do you think that readers, this is a bit of a generalism, but do you think readers are happy to spend money when they can see that it's being spent well? Because a lot of people talk about, you know, the death of print, and actually people just want everything for free online. But, you know, our model at Monocle, I guess Tashin's model as well, is that if you do things properly, you can charge people maybe a premium for it. And they're happy to pay if they consider that they're getting a good value proposition. I don't know, do you wrestle with that balance between spending and the finished product, or do you think that actually it's not something you have to, it's not a calculation you have to make, because people are just happy to do it?
It's a calculation that I have to make all the time. Mm. And of course, the person that does this calculation, both of anyone at Tashit, is Benedict Tashit. He's the guy. But I think what we're talking about there really is scale. Mm. And I think that's the nice thing when you think about how you distribute what you do in such an effective way that you're able to create that scale. Because I think people are willing to pay a little bit more. I think people are not willing to pay insanely more, but they really want to see the quality. Mm. The trade-off that a company will do is to see for what is the scale that I can achieve with that. So let's say Monaco is amazing because you guys distribute worldwide. We distribute also in 70 countries. That makes a huge difference. Mm. I mean, this makes a huge difference for what we can employ in terms of resources into books. I'm pretty sure that a lot of books that we do, that we spend 1.5 or 2 years doing research and paying people so that they're happy working, and we have our... There are not many people that do that these days, but also because they have the difficulty of creating an engine that allows that scale. And I think that's a key thing. in what we do, at least.
That's really interesting. And actually, this idea about the distribution mechanics, often that's the one side of the process which isn't talked about so much. People talk about production costs and journalism and this sort of thing. But the distribution is critical. Do you think that's maybe where, if we look industry-wide, whether it's magazines or in book publishing for that matter, more surgery is needed? I mean, do we need to go back maybe to the older production models where big production houses owned everything through the whole chain? You know, maybe right back to like paper mills, distribution outlets, the whole thing. There aren't many who do that now, or do we need to be more innovative and find solutions that way?
I think after the craziness of the digital world that we thought like everything was going to become digital, things are kind of settling down and we're finding like maybe like a middle ground. One sign of that is that 2015, we're waiting for the numbers of 2016, but in 2015, we had growth in the book industry in the US, for example, after 8 years of decline. It was not a steep decline, but it was like consistent decline. And the other sign is that there were like, I think something like 1,500, if I'm not mistaken, new independent bookstores in the US that were open. So the curve is now changing again. There's a correction that is being made after crisis. Of course, there will be new business models. That's inevitable. Streaming is another industry that is interesting to look at from a business model point of view. What I differ, how I differ, I think, books and magazines and film, for example, is that what we do demands action. You can't be passive. You know, you can, the magazine won't read itself to us like a film does, and I can sleep, and I can go back, and then I can watch again. It demands an effort. And I think that's actually to our advantage. Because if we do a great product and people are really interested in that, they will spend time with what we're doing.
I guess it has a more of a, necessarily almost a more of an emotional impact if they're engaging it with it in that,
yeah,
more,
I think
in that more active
way. It has
way.
Both emotional and intellectual you know, impact on the person. It's more profound because what we do demands that attention that people actually can actually get away by watching the film and doing an email at the same time, which I do. But if you're reading a book, you can't read the book.
You can try, but
you can try. I think you won't be much, you know, you won't be very successful.
Let's just mention the last couple of magazines that you've brought with you, Julius. I see the distinctive yellow frame of a National Geographic
of
product,
course,
which
of
we, given
course,
we look, we talked about the infographics book at the top. Again, I don't know, are you a subscriber? You're always reading their monthly titles and other offshoots? Just a... What does it mean to you when you see that yellow border?
I'm not a subscriber of any magazine these days because I moved so much.
That, somewhere know, they're racking up
It was
huge
becoming
piles
a huge pain. But because I travel also very often, so I'm always picking magazines everywhere. And I think this is a great thing because I'm finding new things, but I have my favorites and stuff, as we talked in the beginning. In the case of National Geographic, what I think is interesting that I had this privilege of working with them for the book was that, you know, they have like three pillars, which is journalism, photography, and mapping. And kind of mapping now is quite broad because, you know, you can, information graphics kind of tries to look more at journalism plus mapping and so on, but photography sometimes as well. They've done a great job always kind of even provoking some discussions. You know, now it's this, when we talk about the solar system, like there are so many thousands of things that we can talk about. And they will have their particular cut that they will make on the subject. And I think it's always refreshing to open a magazine. And even what I would say to everyone when they buy a magazine, don't expect to read the whole magazine. There are parts in the magazine they won't like. Like, I don't read necessarily all the articles when I buy a National Geographic magazine. I'll read most of them, but, you know, I'll read half of it. But if you just pick two or three things that were really well written, photographed, documented, you know, that's already totally worth it. And you won't find this stuff everywhere.
Thank you, Julius. Julius is the editor of National Geographic Infographics, published by Tashin. This is The Stack. We're off to Italy next.
Press Briefing, brought to you by The Stack on Monocle 24. Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg has issued a 5,700-word manifesto, setting out the social media platform's response to fake news and anti-globalization movements. The note, posted on Zuckerberg's Facebook page, illustrates how he believes the network can enhance the shareability of information and create a better world. The message, in part, reads:
"In times like these, the most important thing we at Facebook can do is develop the social infrastructure to give people the power to build a global community that works for all of us."
On the topic of fake news, Zuckerberg wrote,
"If this continues and we lose common understanding, then even if we eliminated all misinformation, people would just emphasize different sets of facts to fit their polarized opinions. That's why I'm so worried about sensationalism in the media."
Part of Facebook's plan to cut the wings of fake news are new measures aimed at detecting whether people actually read an article before they share it. Articles that have been read are given more prominence when shared to other people's newsfeeds. Meanwhile, in Germany, the daily newspaper Bild has issued an apology to its readers following the publication of an article that falsely asserted that a so-called mob of Arab men had sexually assaulted women on New Year's Eve at a restaurant in Frankfurt. The story featured several similarities to genuine attacks that occurred in Germany on New Year's Eve a year earlier, which had resulted in the spread of some anti-migrant sentiment. A spokesperson for the prosecutors in Frankfurt said that authorities are investigating two people suspected of fabricating the story reported by Bild. And the New York Times has appointed an editor to oversee the recruitment of new journalists. Carolyn Ryan led the newspaper's political coverage during the 2016 election. She'll now become an assistant editor as part of efforts to fulfill a series of recommendations set out in a new recent internal report aimed at modernizing and strengthening the company's business model and newsroom.
You're with The Stack, 30 minutes of print industry analysis with me, Tom Edwards. Each week we've been talking to the people behind some of our favourite weekly magazines. Today we're heading to Italy for a look inside the pages of Panorama. Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco spoke to its foreign news senior editor, Elisabetta Barba.
It always belonged to Mondadori. It's a news magazine that covers internal affairs, foreign affairs, economics, culture, and science. It's a, let's say, general news magazine.
And since when are you working for Panorama?
I'm working for Panorama since 99, January 99, quite many years. I started working as a reporter. I've done many things. I've covered wars and I was always around. But when I got children, I preferred to stay in the newsroom. So I started doing editing.
Amazing. And of course, you work in the foreign news part of the magazine as well. Is there like a division? Because of course, it's, you know, it wants to talk to the Italian public. But does the magazine cover a lot of international stories as well? How big is the international coverage of the magazine?
Unfortunately, in Italy, there is not much interest in foreign affairs, or, you know, the editors-in-chief think the public is not so interested in foreign affairs, so all media don't devote much space to this topic, but it's growing, I have to say that, and, you know, especially since everything is so interconnected, it's compulsory now to deal with foreign affairs. Maybe, I don't know, 30 years ago, 40 years ago, the editor-in-chiefs didn't feel compulsory to cover in detail what was going on outside the borders of Italy. But now, we are doing it, even if I would prefer that we covered more international affairs, but you know, that's my point of view. And I'm interested in foreign affairs, so it's normal.
And so am I as well. And Elisabetta, I just want to ask you, what's on the cover of the upcoming issue? And can you tell us which day is Panorama published in the newsstands?
It comes out every Thursday. This cover story is very interesting because it relates to a huge Italian problem, which is youth unemployment. You probably know that we are, I think the rate is 38-39% of Italian youth are unemployed. And there has been a tragedy last week. A young man from a town, it's called Tarcento, near Udine, in the northeast part of Italy, committed suicide. He was unemployed, he couldn't find a job, and he decided to kill himself. And he left a letter saying, among the other things, this generation is taking revenge for the happiness that has been stolen to us. The cover story is about what the editor-in-chief called Generazione Michele. Michele is the name of this boy, of this young man who committed suicide. So it's like Michele is Michael, like Generation Michael, Michael Generation. And then the work that is not there, says the cover story. And there are stories about young people who either, inside the issue, I mean, either don't have a job or they are doing jobs that are not what they had hoped to do when they started attending university or, you know, studying. It's a very sad topic.
It is indeed very sad, but very important. You know, I did hear about the youth unemployment in Italy, you know, because of the laws in the labor market are very rigid as well, from what I heard. But Elisabetta, besides this, quite an interesting, I would like to read this article. Which other stories do you have in this week's issue?
We have a story about all the walls around the world. We have heard a lot about the wall between Mexico and the US, but we have counted how many walls there are around the world right now, and we counted 70 of them in all parts of the world. I would say there is a huge concentration in the Middle East. There are quite a few in Latin America. You know, what's interesting is that I decided to do this story because we have a correspondent from Brazil who kept sending proposals about new walls that were being proposed or built. And I realized that there were 7 only in Latin America. And then I said, let's do a story about all the walls around the world. And it's really amazing. As I said, the Middle East, Latin America, but also in the Balkans, there are quite many. And around Asia, and also in the southern part of the African continent. And the new walls, after September 11th, have been built 45 new walls. We thought, you know, when Berlin Wall was teared down, we thought that it would be the end. It nearly 30 years ago, it was 28 years ago, we thought it would have been the end of walls, but unfortunately, many new ones have come up.
That was Panorama Magazine's Elisabetta Borba speaking to Fernando Augusto Pacheco. And that is all we have time for on this week's programme. Fernando was also our producer today, alongside Ben Rylan and the programme's editor, Claire Urban. Get in touch with Fernando. fp@monocle.com is the address you need. As always, if you fancy buying any of the titles mentioned today, head to the Kiosk Cafe, Monocle's own newsstand over in Paddington here in London. This is The Stack. I'm Tom Edwards. Thank you for tuning in.